for the introduction and the invitations, and thanks everyone for coming. Today I'm going to talk about effective field theories of topological crystalline insulators, and maybe more generally, crystalline SPT phases. So a couple of years ago, we developed this general classification scheme. It's called topological crystal approach. So basically, we showed that these crystalline SPT phases are adiabatically connected to some stacking of lower dimensional topological states. And using this picture, we can do the general classification in real space. And today, I'm going to show you how to apply this picture to derive effective field theory. Before I get started, let me thank my collaborators. And this talk is mostly based on this work I've done with Changze and Jia Bing. But I will review some of the old stories, which is written in these three papers. So to make sure we are on the same page, so what I mean by topological phases are phases of matter with energy back in the bulk. And we could have a bunch of ground states. And this kind of phase of matter are characterized by some patterns of many body entanglement in the ground states. For example, we can have ground states that consist of fluctuating of strings configurations. But today we are going to focus on a much more special topological phases called symmetry protected topological phases. So these are phases where there's a symmetry G and the ground state does not spontaneously break the symmetry. And there's only a unique ground state and with only local excitations. And this ground state becomes trivial if we break all the symmetries. So people will call these ground states children's entangled. So here are some classic examples. For example, in one dimension, we could have a Hebbian chain related by, say, SO3 spin rotation. So and in two dimension, we could have quantum spin Hall insulators or 2D TI. Or in three dimension, we could have three-dimensional topological insulators. And so these SPT phases, the hallmark of these SPT phases is that they have interesting boundary signatures. For example, for the spin 1/2.
Shenjie, may I interrupt you for a sec? Sure. There is a background noise, probably from your side. You know, maybe it will help if you either stabilize your headphone or just take off your headphone. I don't know.
Okay, maybe I just don't use headphone.
Yeah.
Does that sound better?
Yeah, a lot better.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for telling me. And for one-dimensional Hodden chain, the boundary signature is that there were three spin 1/2 sitting at the end of the chain. And for three-dimensional topological insulators, we have this surface Dirac cones, which is the Hallmark signature of this surface of 3D TI. So with crystalline symmetry, there are many more interesting phases. For example, in two dimension, we could have phases with corner modes here. Or in three dimension, we could have hinge modes and corner modes. And usually these modes are protected by crystalline symmetries. And there has been several general approaches in real space. So one of them is called the topological crystal approaches. So basically these are kind of doing the classification as reducing to a special kind of states called topological crystals. And they are, you can think of it as some staking of lower dimensional topological states. And it can be very complicated, the staking as shown in these pictures. And there are two other general approaches. One is called the smooth states, Another is gauging the spatial symmetries. These are developed by Ryan Sundgren and Dominic Els. And later they showed that these pictures, these three different classifications are actually equivalent. So just to be clear, what I mean by general approaches is that it applies to any spatial dimension, any kind of crystalline symmetries. It works for boson and fermions, and you can obtain classifications for non-interacting systems or interacting systems. And the formal mathematical structure is also clear. For the topological crystal approach, is the Edea-Hilbert spectral sequence in some equivariant generalized homology or cohomology. So for free fermion system, we can also do the classification in a momentum space. Oh, sorry, I see. Is my slides moving? No, it's not moving.
And it's frozen.
Oh.
Now it's moving.
Yeah. Oh, now it's moving? Seems like there are some delays.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can also do the classification in momentum space for free fermion systems. And there's a whole bunch of works on along these directions. And this real space approach is really just a complement to that. And we can, sometimes it's hard to see the physical meaning of the case-based classification from, because when you do the classification in momentum space, you obtain a bunch of topological invariant defined in K-space, and sometimes it's hard to obtain a physical picture. And by matching with real space classification, you can clearly see the physical picture. And also because in the real space, it's easier to obtain the boundary signature. So we can also establish the bulk boundary correspondence. But anyway, here is the rough outline. I will first review the topological crystal approach. And then I would talk about how to think about the quantized response in these kinds of systems. Then I will show you how to, through two simple examples, how to derive these quantized responses. And finally, I will present a general form of this kind of effective field theories and the summary outlook. So first, I would like to argue that these crystalline SPT phases are adiabatically connected to the so-called topological crystal states. So as I say, these are states built by staking of lower dimensional topological states as shown in this picture here. So it's like doing a Lego game. We have different Lego with different dimensions. You want to glue them together. And so here are, so what are topological crystals? Here are some more formal definitions. So we will say these are crystalline patterns of some building blocks that staking in the real space in some patterns and respecting the crystalline symmetry. And one important thing is that at some intersections where these building blocks meet, you have to be able to gap out all the gapless modes in order to obtain a completely gap system in the block. Now, a simple example is like weak topological insulators in 3D. So here, the relevant symmetries are charge conservation, time reversal, and lattice translation. Here is the Z direction. So you can think of this as staking of two-dimensional topological insulators along Z directions. So here, the building blocks is just the 2D TI. So here's another example. We have 3D topological crystalline insulators protected by reflection symmetry. Here, the building block is the integer column Hall state, and the reflection symmetry pin the integer column Hall state to the mirror plane. So now I want to tell you why we how do we you know adiabatically deform a generic state into this topological crystal state. So let me explain you through a very simple example. So suppose we have a 3D system, 3D topological crystal insulators protected by reflection symmetry. And I will also assume there's a charge conservation. So we first partition the three-dimensional space into these three regions, left and right, and something in the middle. And because we have reflection symmetry, we can imagine that we change the Hamiltonian or deform the Hamiltonian in this size. We can do whatever we want as long as we do the same thing on the other side. And because we know in a three-dimensional bulk, here I assume the only internal symmetry is charge conservation symmetry. And we know in 3D, there's no 3D SPT protected by just charge U1. So we can clearly, we can deform this bulk, this three-dimensional bulk into a completely trivial state. So everything on the left-hand side and right-hand side are completely trivial. Then we obtain these pictures. I think it's, is it frozen again?
Yes. Yeah, now it seems to work.
Weird. Okay, so now we have this picture. So we have completely trivialized the left-hand side and right-hand side, and that with effective two-dimensional slab. So the next question is to figure out what are possible two-dimensional states that can live on this plane. So on this plane, the reflection symmetry becomes the effective internal Z2 symmetry. So we just need to figure out, so what are the two-dimensional SPT protected by this U1 symmetry and this effective Z2 symmetry. So we could have fermionic Z2 SPT, that's one possibility. It's classified by, it has a Z4 classification. And we could have two-dimensional integer quantum Hall state, or we could have a EA state. But the classification is not just the direct product of these three, because this two-dimensional system is now embedded in the 3D bulk. So there's an extra equivalence relation we need to consider. It's not moving. Okay. Yeah, so we need to, there's an extra equivalence relation we need to consider. We can, you know, bring in extra layers while preserving the reflection symmetries. So this is like an equivalence relation on top of this 2D state. So once you consider that, you will find the classification actually collapse from Z4 times Z to Z8 times Z2. So what happened is that these two copies of integer quantum Hall states is equivalent to Z2 SPT here. And the ESA is reduces to a Z2 classification. So that's basically how we do the classification by using this topological crystal approach. So the question that I would like to address is how do we write down the topological response for these crystal SPT phases? So we know that SPT, we can understand SPT phases by considering the quantized response. A classical example is two-dimensional system with U1 symmetry, and we can couple it to some background U1 gauge field. And one possible response is this kind of Trans-Simons term, where the whole conductance is given by this coefficient. And so, but for crystalline symmetry, we need some notions of crystalline gauge field. And this is first formally defining this Ryan and Dominic's papers, and there are a bunch of papers trying to actually use that to make you some tools that we can compute. And usually, pretty naturally, this crystal gauge field has a very natural interpretation in the topological elasticity theory. So because the system has crystal asymmetry, it's very natural to couple it to some lattice deformations. So in other words, phonons. So then these topological terms of crystal gauge field becomes the topological terms in the theory of phonons, basically. For example, if we only have charge conservation and translation symmetry, we have these kind of terms in various dimensions. So this theta, you can think of it as the phase fluctuation of the density operators. And these are kind of terms you can write out. And so the question is, how do we, there are a couple of questions. So one is, how do we derive these kind of topological terms? And another one is, how do we relate this response or effective scale theories to this general classification? So I will show you that it's sometimes useful to go through this path. We first deform to topological crystal picture and then derive effective field theory. So let's begin with some very simple example. Just go back to this topological crystal insulator example with U1 and the reflection symmetry. So we have this 2D integer quantum Hall states at the mirror plane. And we assume that the bulk is described by this massive Dirac theory. And the reflection acts on the fermion in this way. So now to implement in this kind of so-called dimensional reduction procedure, what we can do is we can add this kind of spatially dependent mass term. So this spatial dependency is in this phi field. So to show that it matches with this building block picture, we can add this mass term and solve the bound state solutions. And you can really see that there will be a bound state at the mirror planes, and this bound state will carry a Chern number equals to one. So the configuration of phi that we choose is shown here. So on the left hand side is minus pi, on the right hand side is pi. This is the requirement from the reflection symmetry. So to derive effective field theory, we can just couple this massive Dirac fermion to a U1 gauge field and with this spatially dependent mass term. And then we integrate all the fermions. We will attain this kind of effective field theories. Yeah, and from this field theory, it's very easy to see that there's a 2D integer quantum Hall state at a mirror plane, because we can just integrate out, say, this y direction. We go back to effective action on this domain wall. So on this domain wall, it's clearly we have this 2D integer quantum Hall state. So that is roughly how we are going to proceed. So then the question is, how do we classify this mass interface systematically? So there's a way to do it very systematically. So we first, from this picture, we know that the space is, we partition the real space into three different parts. Like we have this left-hand side, which is basically a three cell. On the right-hand side, it's also a three cell. And on this 2D plane, it's two cell. So there's a two cell connected to three cell. And on the left-hand side, this function phi is a constant function. But and also on the right hand side is also a constant function. But there could be a 2pi times the integer jumps that happens at these two-dimensional planes. And this jumps is controlled by an integer value function that defined on this 2D plane, this R. So reflection, you can show that reflection symmetry actually acts on this integer function R in this way. But there's a redundancy because when you modify this integer function by this 2pi h, and also modify r at the same time in this way, we have the same interface configuration. So this shows that this r, this integer value function, is actually a cocycle in this h of one cohomology. But this cohomology is the cohomology of the manifold. But it does not mean that this cocycle or is classified by this group cohomology in the manifold. Actually, it's classified by this cohomology of the corresponding space of Z2. So how do we see that? So this comes from the fact that there's a natural map from our manifold to the corresponding space of Z2. So why there's this natural map? So actually this comes from a very special property of crystalline symmetry. So it's called a fundamental domain. So like we have this picture, like we have the left-hand side and the right-hand side in the real space and connected by some 2D planes. So actually this two-dimensional plane can be labeled by a group element. Here is the reflection. And we can label the left-hand side by say identity element, the right-hand side, say this reflection, the non-trivial Z2 element. And they will satisfy the group multiplication law. And this property is general for any crystalline symmetries. And the fact that we have this property is because we have a map from M to the corresponding space. So, sorry, I saw it's freezing. Sorry, I don't know why it keeps freezing. So let me first review one of the construction of the corresponding space. So this construction works for a discrete group. So in a corresponding space, there's a unique zero cell, which is shown by this dot. And there's a one cell which are labeled by the group element. So these two circles are actually identified together in the corresponding space. So this is like a loop. And we also attach a two cell in this triangle. But the boundary of this triangles satisfy the group multiplication rules. So there's actually no new data here. And we just keep going. We attach like three cells to the interior of tetrahedra and so on. And by construction, this space has a property that the first homotopy group pi one of BG equals to G. And the higher homotopy groups equals to zero, I will trivial. So now we have this cell decomposition in real space. It's given by this fundamental domain. So now it's clear that why we have this map. So we just go to the dual cell decomposition. So this three cell is dual to a zero cell, shown in these blue dots here and here. And this two cell is dual to a one cell. So it's dual to these blue lines here. And the map, there's an actual map that maps these zero cells, dual zero cells, to the base point of the classifying space, this green dot. And this one cell is naturally mapped to the one cells in the classifying space. So that is why you can label these paths by a group element in the crystalline group, in the spatial, in the reflection symmetry. So the correct statement is that these mass interface are actually classified by this first cohomology of classifying space with integer coefficient. And this integer value function defined in the real space actually the pullback of this cohomology class. So you can actually calculate this cohomology group is a Z2 class, is a Z2 group. So that means that we have trivial and only one non-trivial class of mass interfaces. So the non-trivial one is what I drew is the one we have two pi jumps at a mere point. The trivial one is we have four pi jumps here. And you can see pictorially why this is trivial, because you can, once you have four pi jumps, you can smoothly deform this mass interface in this way, such that there's no jumps at all.
Question?
Yeah.
So Shenjie, can you go back one slide to this this map from the space to BG?
So here
I want to make sure I actually understand. So so suppose I have not reflection but some C2 rotation, let's say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How would this work? Because there the invariant space is going to be an axis, so the dual is going to be a two cell. How are you going to map that to a single group element?
You're thinking about map a two cell to the two cell will map to some two cell in the classifying space.
Right.
And in the classifying space, you map to several, you first need to decompose this loop into some triangles and map each triangle to a triangle in the classifying space. Roughly, that's how it works.
But I thought you just explained that the two cell in the classifying space is not going to correspond to a single group element.
No, it will be labeled by two group elements.
Sorry. Yeah, because that Okay. I confused it with some other thing. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Go on.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So previously you mentioned there was a wrong classification of the R, which is HF1 M, comma Z R. So I want to ask, just physically, what's wrong? Is it incomplete or overcomplete, and why?
So you mean here, right?
Yeah.
So this argument just shows that R is a Z value cocycle in this H of one, M comma Z. But it's not classified by this cohomology group, because it does not contain any information of reflection symmetry and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a property of a manifold. And the information of a symmetry actually encodes in this comma H of one B Z two comma Z.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So let me go back. So once we understand the classifying group of this deformation class of mass interface, so we can go back to our effective field theory, because this kind of jump, a sharp jump, is kind of not very physical. But to go to a true IR limit, we can now take a smooth jump. We can, as I draw here, this interface can vary very smoothly as long as we maintain in the same Kolmogorov class, meaning maintaining this jump. So the equation now becomes something like this is like an integer equation. So you integrate from somewhere very far to the left and then integrate to the right. It equals to an integer. So this dp is a one form with integral periods. And this period is determined by this Kolmogorov group. Okay, so that's always okay. So we can do it for other symmetries. For example, this is example for CNV symmetry. And it looks very similar to the case with only reflection symmetry. We have this condition here. And it shows that when we integrate through some passing through these mirror planes, there's a jump, which encoding is R. But if we integrate along a path that is labeled by a rotational symmetry, for C2 case, that is this path, there has to be no jumps, because according to this picture, we must have this alternating orientation of these intercolumnar states in order to get out all the edge modes at the center. Otherwise, when it's a 4-point meet, there will be some garbage edge modes left. So that's basically the story for this point group symmetry protected TCIs.
Sorry, I think I have a very basic question.
Yeah.
Basically, I want to ask, what's the how do I know the term on this page is a topological term at all? What's the rules of the game to determine whether such a term is topological? I'm asking because you constructed it by first doing dimensional reduction, but that's a particular way of construct this topological state. And in that way, you use this variable phi or p to express the response function. But how do I know this is really the intrinsic topological characterization?
So the logic is that this topological crystal state is kind of like a representative of the whole phase. So yeah. We first go to this limit, and then from this limit, we derive the topological terms. And so this term should be valid for all phase.
And then I have to make sure this is a topological term.
You have what?
I have to make sure this is a topological term.
Uh-huh.
So how do I see that?
It depends on your definition of topological term, I think. Well, first, it does that depends on metric, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And the unclosed manifold is somehow quantized?
Yeah, this coefficient is quantized. The coefficient in front of it can show it's quantized by gauge invariant.
Mm-hmm. Mm, okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So with these topological terms, we can write out some more physical response. So for example, by gauge invariance, we can show that this current is conserved. This one. So this looks like a current in a 3D column hole, where this usually will have axion-like response. So this P is like an axion, this theta. But now for different crystalline symmetries, this theta or this dp will look different. It will satisfy different these integral equations. But the response look the same. We have 3D column hole, and we have this 3D hole conductance. And this hole conductance is generally space-time dependent, and it's not quantized by itself. The quantized quantity is the, when you integrate this hole conductance along some path, it's quantized. And it's basically determined by this job. So how do we generalize this to include translation symmetry, say? So to apply this to translation symmetry, we need an extra assumption, basically. Because when we do dimensional reduction, we want to trivialize some regions in space. But with translation symmetry, you think about it as some lattice model, it does not make sense to say, I want to trivialize everything in a unit cell, because inside a unit cell, there's nothing. So to apply this argument, we need to add some ancillas within the unit cell and assume that we can tune the correlation length to arbitrarily small value, and while keep the gap open. So this is an assumption that is used in these two different approaches. And here I will give you an example to tell you how to actually do that in some specific model. So we focus on one-dimensional atomic insulators with charge conservation and translation symmetry. So it is described by this kind of time binding model. But instead of original time binding model, here we add some ancillas inside a unit cell. So the original unit cell size is this little a. But we add more ancillas to obtain a new lattice, where the new lattice constant is this small l. So it's a much finer lattice. And we do that, we will add these chemical potential terms and to keep the filling the same as the original filling we want. So the transition symmetry is determined by this original unit cell A. It acts on the fermion in this way. Now we want to go to the low energy limit. We expand these lattice fermions in this way around the Fermi momentum, around the Fermi energy. The low energy theory is described by these massive Dirac fermions again. But now the transition acts on this low energy field besides this some part acting on the internal space, it also shifts the coordinate. So the translation does not act on like an unsized symmetry. Yeah, the translation does not act like an internal symmetry, because now this A is like a very large length scales in this field theory. So this is different from the usual low energy IR theory. So this fermion field size is smooth at the scale of this little L, but not smooth on the scale of this A. But to apply this dimensional reduction picture, we need to go to this special kind of limit. So in this limit, we add this kind of specially dependent mass term with this special dependence is encoded in its phase phi. So now it makes sense to talk about some mass interface with variations within the size of unit cell, because now it's the size of unit cell is kind of a large length scale. So we add this kind of term, and how do we recover that there's a charge one per unit cell? How do we recover this microscopic picture? So we require that this phi has some jumps, and we know that at the jumps, there will be some bounces that trap at the jump. So transition symmetry actually requires that this phi field satisfy this equation. So the filling determines the jumps in this phi field actually. So when you have integer fillings, the translation symmetry requires that we have 2 pi jumps at the location of the charges. And then to derive the effective field theory, we can couple it to the U1 gauge field and then integrate out the fermion. The effective field theory looks like this. And you can see that this gives you what we want because we consider this kind of configuration of phi. We have series of jumps, 2 pi jumps at the location of the particles. And using this configuration, you integrate out the x direction. We have a bunch of zero fast 1D action that describes this particle. So we recover that, you know, this system has a charge one per unit cell. Yeah, you can also see that this density is given by this, and we focus on the charge density. So we should basically define, and using this configuration, we recover that this discrete nature of the density. Oh, sorry. I don't know why it keeps freezing. Yeah, it's here. So then I want to tell you how do we obtain the classification of this deformation class of this mass interface. So it's similar to the previous example. We first do the cell decomposition in real space. So we have this one cell that's labeled corresponds to the unit cell. And you have this zero cell is the location of the particle. And so within the one cell, these phi field are basically integer valued function, a constant value function. And this jumps is encoded at these integer value functions. Defined at a zero cell. And you can show that this integer value function tau satisfies this kind of equation. It will become the cocycle condition. And also there's a redundancy because when you modify the phi field in this way, at the same time you modify this integer value function in this way, you obtain the same configuration of the mass interface. So this is a redundancy. So this shows that this tau is a z value cocycle in this h of one m comma z. But the deformation class, similar to using the previous arguments, the deformation class is classified by this h of one b gamma comma z. This gamma is the translation group, this discrete translation group. So we can, the correct answer is we need to first calculate this and then using the map from M to B gamma, pull it back to the real space. Any questions? Yeah, so once we understand that, we can safely take the smooth limit while maintaining in the same cohomology class. In the smooth limit, this condition of these jumps is replaced by some integer equation, looks like this. So we integrate over a unit cell, this phi has to have a 2 pi jumps. Now I put it back to the size of the unit cell. So it's a 2 pi over 8 jumps. So we can solve that. The simplest little configuration looks like this. So it is just a straight line. But at the location of the particle, it equals to 2 pi over 8 or 2 pi. We set a to equals 1. So if you are familiar with this whole dense approach of polarizations, this is actually the labeling field he introduced. So at the location of these particles, this labeling field is equals to 2 pi. And using this, we can also study study the theory of phonons where these particles start to fluctuate. And so this phi field could have its own dynamics. So this, we can define one form through this phi field. We can define one form equals to d phi over 2 pi. This is essentially the elastic tactile veil bind in the topological elasticity theory. Yeah, and this can be generalized to various dimensions. So in one dimension, we have this kind of term. So in two dimensions, it looks like this. In three dimensions, it looks like this. So they're all very similar. So this result has been derived in the elasticity theory before. Here, we just reproduce the result. So I guess the important thing is that this one form is classified by this cohomology. It's big gamma comma b. So in general, we can just summarize what we found and write down the effective field theory in this way. In general dimensions, when we have building blocks that is described by this kind of transimous term, the effective field theory of TCI is given by you wedge this transimous term by some K form and satisfy this kind of integral equations, where this C of G is like K cycle that encodes some high symmetry points or high symmetry lines or points that basically tells you where to decorate these building blocks. And in the paper, we studied this bunch of different examples. The one I didn't talk about is this two-dimensional case with CN rotations. But you can look at the paper. It's all follow the parallel arguments. So that's basically what I want to talk about. So I have told you it's useful to derive effective field theory of TCI. It's useful to first go to the limits of topological crystal states, and then derive the effective action from there. And in this work, we only consider the building block has this transimon kind of response, like intercolumnar whole state. And in the future, I think it would be interesting to study, different kinds of building blocks. For example, these building blocks could be sensitive to point group actions. You could carry non-trivial point group charges. And there will be new topological terms associated to those states. And it will be also interesting to generalize it to other full space group symmetries. So far, we only consider point groups or transition groups, but that both. And It would be also interesting to generalize to topological order states, gauge theories, semi-metals, and so on. And also this kind of field theory is like the simplest kind of example where we have these networks of defects, like, but each defect is like an invertible or SPT phases. You can imagine that we can replace these defects by some topological order state or non-invertible states. You know, it would be still described by this kind of field theories. And it would be interesting to explore that. Okay, I guess I will stop here.
All right, thanks, Shenjie. Any questions from the audience?
So for these gauge fields E that you introduced in the end, so what are the gauge transformations?
So let me go back to. Maybe we can just look at this picture. So E is basically d phi over 2 pi, where phi will have this kind of jumps. And the gauge transformation is like you shift the whole diagram by 2 pi.
Okay. But on the other hand, you know, there seems to be.
Yeah, it's given by
reciprocal lattice vector, right? Maybe I'm confused because this is, you are using the same notation as in these papers by Volovic, where they, you know, basically identify E with the reciprocal lattice vector, right?
You can sort of see that in the smooth limit. In the smooth limit, this phi is basically like a straight line.
Right.
So this B is the reciprocal lattice.
Right. Yeah, but then it's kind of becomes unclear why is it a gauge field? Is it related to a reciprocal lattice vector? That's more or less that's an observer. That's a fixed.
I guess the question is what is the definition of this crystalline gauge field or translation gauge field here. Do you view any one phone that in this cohomology class has translation gauge field or something?
Right. A related question is what is the is there a connection between this formulation and, you know, let's say the one in our paper where it's really an integer gauge field.
Yeah.
How do you connect the two?
Yeah, certainly in this smooth limit, it does not look like a gauge field, but it still satisfies the same kind of integral condition. But it does not look like you have the gauge field defined on a link or something.
Okay.
Yeah, that is more like in this discrete limit, we have this sharp jump.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very clear what the physical interpretation of a translation gauge field should be anyway, right?
Yeah. Is this Dominic?
I mean, you could sort of just define this to be a translation gauge field because it's not a sufficiently well-defined term that would be a wrong definition, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Do you think we should view anything classified by this H of one B gamma comma Z as translation gauge field?
I mean, formally, why not?
Yeah, that's kind of my feeling. But the actual cycle could look very different.
All right, any other questions? All right, so if not, let's thank Xunjie today for the talk.
And hey, thank you.